On the evening of December 26th, 1898, three siblings of a large farming family known as the Murphys rode in a horse-drawn cart down a rural road in Queensland, Australia, toward the tiny town of Gatton. It was the day after Christmas, or rather, Boxing Day, which is a continuation of the Christmas holiday celebrated in Britain and other parts of Europe. Gatton, which had a population of only 450 in 1900, sustained a community of Irish, German, and English families, so Boxing Day was observed by most, if not all, local residents. As parts of Australia were still colonized by the British in 1898, Boxing Day was widely celebrated and carried a tradition of charity and goodwill toward others. Unfortunately for Michael, Nora, and Ellen Murphy, they would encounter anything but peace and goodwill on the road that night. The siblings decided to attend a town dance at the Tarampa Divisional Hall, which was a few miles away from their family's farm. Dressed in their best finery, Michael, who was 29 and back home for the holidays from his job at an experimental government farm nearby, decided to take his younger sisters, Nora, 27, and Ellen, 18, into town for some socializing, despite their overbearing mother Mary's misgivings. When they got to town, they found the dance hall dark and empty. The festivities had been canceled. Witnesses reported the Murphy cart, also called a sulky, immediately turned around and creaked back toward their farm. Early the next morning, the Murphy family woke to find that Michael, Nora, and Ellen had not returned during the night. Unaware that the dance had been canceled, they initially weren't concerned. Farmtown dances were known to carry on until the wee hours of the morning, but when the trio hadn't shown up by 8 a.m., William McNeil, the husband of the eldest Murphy child, decided to take a horse and go looking for them. It did not take long for him to find the distinctive tracks of the cart along the road. The cart that the Murphys had taken to the dance belonged to McNeil, and it had a crooked wheel that left easily discernible divots on the dirt road. McNeil followed the tracks into a nearby paddock, a fenced-in grassy area used to graze horses and cattle. Not far from the road, he found a strange scene. In a gum tree grove, McNeil saw from a distance his in-laws lying on the ground. To him, they appeared to be sleeping. As he got closer, however, he realized their state was anything but a peaceful slumber. Michael, Nora, and Ellen were all lying dead beneath the hot Australian summer sun, brutally murdered by an unknown assailant. The brutality of the crimes shocked, frightened, and intrigued the tiny town and its 450 inhabitants, who expected the murders to be solved within a day or two. The subsequent botched investigation, however, turned the Gatton mystery into one of the most notorious unsolved murder cases in all of Australia, one that still tantalizes amateur and professional sleuths to this day. This is the story of the Gatton murders. The village of Gatton is located about 60 miles west of Brisbane in southeastern Australia. It began as a small settlement used by Royal Mail coaches to change and water their horses during long journeys, essentially a pit stop. By the mid-1850s, the village received their gazettal, which means an official publication was established for the purposes of providing the British colonial government with various information like land acquisition notices, government orders, and bylaws of companies under royal charter. This is the first step towards becoming a true residential area, and by the 1860s, land allotments were being sold to private families. Once a rail station was established in Gatton in 1875, the town and the surrounding farmlands began to grow. It became a desirable settlement place for immigrant families looking for affordable land and new prospects for their children. Dan Daniel Murphy Sr., patriarch of the Murphy family, and his soon-to-be matriarch, Mary Holland, immigrated to Australia from Ireland separately sometime between 1862 and 1865. Immigration from Ireland to Australia boomed during these years as immigration to the US slowed to a trickle during the Civil War due to naval blockades. As was common for immigrant laborers, Daniel obtained work building the railroad shortly after his arrival. He installed rail in between the cities of Ipswich and Toowoomba, in the middle of which lay the town of Gatton. He met Mary Holland, who was most likely working as a domestic servant, and the two married sometime around 1866, settling on a rented farm outside of Gatton along a creek known as Blackfellows. With the help of their future 10 children, the Murphys managed to carve out a relatively comfortable existence for themselves over the next 30-plus years. By 1898, their rental property spanned over 300 acres of green, tree-filled pastures and land for cultivating dairy cattle. 8 of their 10 children were still living within their 5-room cottage. William, who was 31 years old, Nora, 27, Patrick, 24, Jeremiah, 20, Ellen, 18, John, 15, and 13-year-old Catherine. 29-year-old Michael and 21-year-old Daniel had both moved out. Michael worked on the Westbrook Experimental Farm a few miles away, and Daniel lived and worked in Brisbane as a constable, or police officer. The eldest Murphy child, Polly, was 32 and the only one that was married. She and her husband, William McNeil, and their two daughters had recently moved back in with her family following a disabling accident that left Polly partially paralyzed. The family seemed insular, if not hopelessly under the control of the matriarch. Mary Murphy, formerly Mary Holland, allegedly ruled her family with an iron fist, and her word was law in the household. Daniel Murphy, her husband, was a man of few words, an introvert who performed his farm work diligently and preferred to spend his quiet hours praying alone in his bedroom. The intricacies of the Murphy family dynamic are not entirely known, but one might be able to glean some insight from the fact that in an age where marriage and children were tantamount to independence, the Murphys had 7 children over the age of 18 who had yet to find partners and only 2 who had moved away full-time. What is known about the family is that they were considered respectable in their township, which for Daniel Sr. and Mary, who started their lives as poor, barely literate Irish Catholic immigrants, was worth its weight in gold. The family was intensely religious and patronized Gatton's St. Mary's Catholic Church. On Christmas Day, 1898, the entire Murphy clan, excluding Daniel, who was back in Brisbane on police duty, went to Christmas Mass. It was reported that the family was in high spirits on the holiday. The city of Gatton offered residents a relatively lively social life for such a rural place, with a cricket club, tennis club, dog tracks, fairs and festivals, and housework competitions. There was never a shortage of community activities nearby to partake in, especially around Christmas. On Boxing Day, several of the Murphy children, including Ellen, Michael, William, John, Polly, and her husband William McNeil, all went to the horse racetrack in nearby Mount Silva. They spent the day watching the races, eating, and drinking to celebrate the holiday. But the real attraction was a dance being held in the town of Gatton that night. For the young single people in town, the country dances offered the best venue to cozy up to new romantic partners. Not all of the Murphys were going to the dance that night. Michael offered to take his 2 sisters, Nora and Ellen, into town for the party. Their brother-in-law offered them the use of his cart so that the 2 younger women wouldn't have to ride on horseback. Attached to his hip, Michael carried a small leather purse with 15 shillings in it to treat his sisters to whatever they desired that night. Michael Murphy was closing out his 20s with a reputation as an integrity-driven hard worker with good looks. Physically fit and an excellent horse rider, Murphy volunteered part-time as a mounted infantry sergeant. 18-year-old Ellen Murphy was described as a handsome and lively young woman with zeal. She caught the eye of many young men in the area, but she was apparently sweet on a musician playing at the Gatton dance that night. Their sister, Nora, who was 27, was intelligent and apparently had suitors of her own. However, she lived her life for her family. Both women helped their mother keep house, but Nora's role in the homemaking seemed to be invaluable. She cooked and cleaned for the family while caring for Polly's two young children. The Gatton dance on Boxing Day seemed to be a rare opportunity for Nora to not so metaphorically let her hair down. Michael donned a three-piece suit, and both women dressed in long, attractive dark skirts with light-colored blouses. They squeezed into the small horse-drawn cart and started towards Gatton around 7 p.m. Allegedly, they were all smiles and excitement as they pulled away from their parents' property. Sadly, though, it was the last their family would see any of them alive. The next morning, on December 27th, the Murphys rose from bed one by one and began attending to their normal farm duties. The yard was empty. Neither horse nor sulky cart were present. Michael, Nora, and Ellen had not yet returned from town. No one on the farm was aware that the Gatton dance had been canceled the night before, and that the trio should have arrived home long before morning. According to statements given by the family, William McNeil was the first of them to become worried about the whereabouts of the Murphy children. From the moment he appeared out of his bedroom, he expressed concern. His cart was old and unreliable, he said. It had a bum wheel and could have broken down somewhere along the road on their way back to the farm. Most of the family remained initially unconcerned until Mrs. Murphy finally asked McNeil to take one of the horses and go search for them. McNeil immediately set off toward Gatton, keeping his eyes peeled for the tracks of a sulky cart. The time was around 8 a.m. Along the main road to Gatton, known as Tent Hill Road, McNeil came upon the distinctive tracks he recognized as belonging to his old cart. They veered off of the road into a large paddock belonging to one of the neighbors. McNeil followed the tracks to the edge of the paddock. He had to remove the wooden planks from the slip rail fence to enter, and then followed the cart tracks in and out of the paddock for a few hundred yards. After a few minutes of searching, he caught a glimpse of what looked like piles of clothing lying perfectly still beneath the hot summer sun. Nearby sat his cart. The horse was lying on the ground. According to a statement given by McNeil, "I thought they were sleeping in the sun. After I got a bit closer, I saw the clothing of the girls was disarranged, and then I could see the ants crawling all over them. I did not go any further." William McNeil ran back to the edge of the pasture, jumped on his horse, and rode into town. He stopped at the Brian Boru Hotel and told people inside that he had discovered three dead Murphy children in a paddock nearby, before going on to the police station to report the crime. His stop at the hotel would end up causing severe problems for the investigators, as word of the horrific deaths spread throughout the town. William McNeil found a constable named Sergeant Arell alone at the police barracks and told him what he'd found. The two men rode on horseback toward the crime scene. On the road, they found the proprietor of the Brian Boru Hotel, Mr. Gilbert, traveling with three other men who had hopped into a horse and buggy and were riding out to investigate McNeil's claims themselves. Together, the six men found a nightmare-inducing scene that would haunt Gatton and the nation for generations to come. At first glance, the bodies appeared serene, just as William McNeil had said. Nora's body was lying almost face down on a rug spread beneath a gum tree. A few yards away from her, Ellen and Michael lay back to back. The bodies formed a rudimentary triangle with the sulky cart and the horse, which had been shot through the head, acting as the third point. Each of the victims' feet had been positioned to point westward. Nora and Ellen's hands were tied behind their backs with their own handkerchiefs, while Michael's hands were left free. Abrasions on his wrist indicated that he may have been bound at some point, and a leather ratchet strap was found a few feet from his body. Clutched between his hands was the leather purse, empty of the 15 shillings he had taken with him for the festivities the night before. The initial viewers of the crime scene knew they needed a medical examiner to perform a post-mortem examination to learn the extent of the victim's injuries, but they could see plainly from where they were standing that both Ellen and Nora had been raped. Nora's clothing was torn apart and her body was horrifically scratched. Her skirt was pulled up around her waist and her shirt torn open so her breasts were visible. On her face, in addition to dozens of scratches, was a several-inch-long laceration along her right eye socket, indicating someone had slashed at her face with a knife. Ellen's body, though still badly scratched, didn't appear to be as brutally marred, but all three of the Murphy children had had their skulls bashed in with a heavy object. A bloody tree branch was found nearby. Michael appeared to have a small bullet hole through the forehead, but neither of the two sisters looked like they had been shot. One look at the brutality and scope of the bloody murder scene had Sergeant Arell running for the Gatton Telegraph Office. He knew that his rural police outfit lacked the manpower and know-how to handle a triple homicide, so he went into town to send an urgent message to the police commissioner in Brisbane, the largest major city nearby. He left Mr. Gilbert and his three companions to fend off any curious townfolk who showed up to peruse the crime scene. William McNeil rode back to the Murphy farm to inform the family of the murders. Shock and disbelief rippled through the family members as he told them. It is said that Daniel Murphy Sr. almost collapsed upon hearing the news, and Mary Murphy cried out for her poor children. Immediately, Mary wanted McNeil to take her to the crime scene, so they strapped two horses to the family buggy and made haste. She made sure to pack bedsheets to cover up the bodies of her slain children. When they arrived back at the crime scene, it was overrun with people. The men that Sergeant Arell had left behind to guard the bodies had been unable or unwilling to keep bystanders from trampling all over the crime scene. The tracks leading from the slip rails to the bodies were all but destroyed. Evidence was handled and moved. The bodies of the Murphy children were being viewed like morbid sideshow attractions. Sergeant Arell managed to fire off a telegraph message to Brisbane by midday and hurried back to the scene. After spending the better part of the afternoon shooing away morbidly curious laypeople, Arell and his helpers butchered the Murphy horse in the paddock and recovered a .380 caliber bullet from between its eyes. Arell wanted to wait for a reply from Brisbane before moving the bodies. However, it would take several hours for the report to be taken seriously by the chief investigators, and a full 24 hours for anyone from Brisbane's criminal investigation branch to be dispatched to Gatton to take over the investigation. As the sun blazed overhead and began to cook the bodies, people at the scene finally convinced Arell to move the bodies back to the hotel in Gatton to await the medical examiner. William McNeil helped put the bodies in the Murphy buggy and drove them to the hotel. It was perhaps the only sound decision police made concerning this case in the first 48 hours. The medical inspector, Dr. Von Lossberg, arrived via train from the nearby town of Ipswich by 4 p.m. the day the bodies were discovered. By 7:30, his autopsies, if you can call them that, were complete, and he was already boarding the train back home. The following is a brief summary of Von Lossberg's post-mortem examinations of Nora, Ellen, and Michael. Ellen Murphy sustained a crushing blow to the head. The skull was so horribly fractured, her brain matter was visible through what remained of her hair. Dr. Von Lossberg found evidence of rape all over her person. Someone had torn her undergarments, and there were scratches and fingernail marks on the inside of her thighs and on her buttocks. Her exterior sexual organs were swollen and bruised, and inside, the doctor determined her hymen had been recently ruptured. Given the positioning of some of the scratches, it also looked like she had been sodomized. Blood and semen were left on her thighs, legs, and outer clothing. Her hands were bound tightly behind her back with her own handkerchief. If possible, Nora's attack looked even worse. Ellen was badly scratched, but Nora looked as though she had been beaten with a barbed stick. Her under and outer clothing, including her underwear, blouse, skirt, and jacket, was shredded, and she sustained similar injuries to her sexual organs. On her hands and knees, the doctor reported severe abrasions, and her neck had been bound tightly with a leather strap. She had probably been in and out of consciousness during the attack due to the restriction of airflow. The handkerchief which bound her hands had been tied so tightly, her hands had turned blue. The extent of her injuries suggested Nora had been gang-raped. Her attackers crushed the left side of her skull with a heavy object. Michael, their brother, also appeared to have been sexually assaulted in some way. The doctor found semen present on the inside and outside of the front of his pants, and the foreskin of his penis was badly swollen. Though he wasn't found with bound hands, he had strap impressions on his wrist, suggesting he'd been tightly bound at some point before his death. Someone had beaten his skull on the right side. Michael also had a possible bullet wound to the head, but Dr. von Lossberg claimed no bullet was present and dismissed the thought. Each of the victims had blood impressions on their clothes and skin that looked like they came from a corduroy-type fabric. There was also evidence that both women had been violated with the handle of a brass riding whip, which was missing from the scene. The main problem with Dr. von Lossberg's evaluation of the bodies was a lack of thoroughness. He didn't open up the corpses, and he rushed through the exams. Later, in 1899, during a Royal Commission's inquiry into the police department's conduct during this investigation, von Lossberg's examinations would come under heavy scrutiny, as would the conduct of the head of the CIB, Frederick Urquhart, who arrived in Gatton the next day just in time for the funerals. The local magistrates gave clearance for the bodies of the Murphy children to be buried the following day, December 28th, 2 days after their murders. Oddly, William McNeil, their brother-in-law, insisted on paying for the funerals of all three. Mourners came to pay their respects at St. Mary's Catholic Church, and the Murphy children were laid to rest. Sergeant Frederick Urquhart caught a train from Brisbane to Gatton the morning of the 28th, and arrived at the crime scene a full 24 hours after the bodies had been found. By January 5th, 1899, 9 days after the crime, the Brisbane Police Commissioner officially put Urquhart in charge of the Gatton murders investigation. Frederick Urquhart was born into a family of ancient Scottish aristocracy and educated in an English boarding house. After running away from home as a teenager, he worked his way aboard a boat to get to Australia, where he spent many years as a bushman for the Electric Telegraph Company. He became a police officer in 1889. By the late 1890s, he was appointed the head of the Criminal Investigation Branch, despite having a reputation for being arrogant, vindictive, and unwilling to listen to the opinions of others. After reviewing the scant evidence in this case and discussing the lackluster post-mortem medical examinations with the constables and magistrates who were present, Urquhart immediately decided to exhume the bodies to see if more evidence could be found. Police brought in Dr. Ray, the chief government medical officer, to perform thorough autopsies on the three bodies. He was able to determine straight away that Michael had in fact been shot through the head and retrieved a .380 caliber bullet from his skull, the same caliber of ammunition extracted from their horse. Another important determination made by Dr. Ray was he believed the perpetrators had been left-handed or ambidextrous. That tidbit could be helpful for investigators when narrowing down suspects in the coming months. After taking stock of what remained of the crime scene, the evidence, and the autopsies, Urquhart sent a telegram back to his superiors in Brisbane, stating, "Circumstances point to premeditation. Details most atrocious. There is so far nothing to lay hold of." Now, we're going to pause for just a moment to hear a word from today's sponsors. The case received considerable attention from newspapers and ordinary citizens all over Australia. Almost at once, police began receiving an outpouring of letters containing various armchair sleuth theories as to who was responsible. After it was reported that a woman staying in a house close by the murder scene heard a female voice cry out, "Father," a popular theory emerged. Perhaps Daniel Murphy Sr. had killed his children after discovering some form of incest between them. Worse, others went one step further to suggest Mr. Murphy was having inappropriate relations with his adult daughters himself. For a family that prided themselves on the respectable position they held within their community, these accusations were devastating. Though this theory was never seriously entertained by investigators, the Murphy clan almost immediately clammed up and withheld any and all help from the police. The only exception being, of course, Daniel Murphy Jr., who was himself a police officer and bound by his profession to help in the investigation. Allegedly, the Murphys even refused to provide horses to aid searchers looking for clues through the paddock. Police had to source their mounts from other farms. The situation for police was made much worse following the discovery of the body of a 15-year-old boy named Alfred Hill, 40 miles away from Gatton. Reported missing by his parents on December 10th, his body was found on January 7th in a wild brush. His pony had been shot between the eyes, just like the Murphy horse. Alfred had been shot in the head with a .380 caliber gun, and his feet were arranged pointing west. Police immediately suspected his murder was connected with the Murphys. The savage murder of Alfred Hill added to the distress and hysteria of the public, and the press launched a full-scale attack on the CIB. Author Stephanie Barnett recorded the following newspaper clip in her book about the Gatton murders, printed by the Brisbane Courier on January 9th. Quote, "The police have failed to justify their existence as guardians of the public peace in the two tragedies, if not in connection with the Ipswich Horror at Gatton. The possibilities of successful detection were made nearly hopeless at the commencement, but lack of organization which allowed tracks to be obliterated and clues to be destroyed. While the post-mortem examinations of the bodies seems to have been little better than perfunctory, these and other matters have awaited comment. We have purposely withheld criticism because, as soon as the gravity of the situation appeared, the authorities grappled their task with the greatest energy and enthusiasm." Unquote. The relationship between police and the press continued to deteriorate over the next few months as the police chased leads to dead ends, and the likelihood of solving the Murphy case became increasingly hopeless. Frederick Urquhart, who had a reputation for being particularly sensitive to criticism, reacted poorly to the press coverage of his investigation, and all but refused to entertain any possible motives or suspects outside of his own purview. Although many Gatton residents believed that several attackers had murdered the Murphys, Sergeant Urquhart made up his mind that the murders were the work of a single transient laborer who was not local to the region. His focus immediately fell to a man named Richard Burgess, an ex-convict who had arrived in the area in early December. Burgess was released from his most recent prison stay on November 30th, 1898, after a six-month sentence for raping an elderly woman near the town of Toowoomba, 20 miles from Gatton. By the end of the first week of December, he was back in Brisbane. His location was always hard to pin down because he drifted from place to place, but he was arrested 60 miles north of Toowoomba on January 6th for peculiar behavior. Police scrounged up a witness who said they saw someone who looked like Burgess lurking around where Alfred Hill was murdered, and given his criminal history, police suspected him of the Gatton murders, despite eyewitnesses that put Burgess nowhere near Gatton on Boxing Day. He was held in jail for several weeks for stealing a saddle while police tried to find evidence to charge him with the murders. However, his alibi proved to be ironclad. He was released from police custody in March of 1899 and then left Australia shortly thereafter. A few weeks after the murders, it came to light that the victim Michael Murphy, previously portrayed as the soul of integrity, may have had several sexual relationships with unmarried women around Gatton. There were rumors that he had fathered at least a few children out of wedlock, with one pregnancy resulting in the death of the young woman, named Kate Ryan, during childbirth. The story went that Michael seduced Kate, got her pregnant, and when the subject of marriage came up, his sisters Nora and Ellen were violently opposed to the match. Perhaps Michael's philandering had angered relatives of the woman, who then sought revenge in the worst possible way. It's impossible to know, but Frederick Urquhart insisted that the Kate Ryan story was false. According to him, though this Kate Ryan in question had a child out of wedlock, she had since married someone else and was living peacefully. Another theory that was bandied about was that Nora Murphy had brought the attack on her and her siblings after tormenting an old teacher to the brink of insanity. Nora had allegedly sent some nasty letters attacking the character of this teacher to a Queensland newspaper, who had promptly published them. The episode caused this woman to have a breakdown, and her sisters vowed revenge. Again, this was another theory that went nowhere. Another theory that did seem to have some legs, though, was that of William McNeil, the brother-in-law of the three victims. His proximity to the murders and his involvement in the investigation seemed to raise some eyebrows. McNeil did not have the best relationship with his in-laws, and the circumstances surrounding his marriage to Polly Murphy, Mary and Daniel's eldest child, were strained. For one, McNeil was a Protestant. For the devoutly Catholic Mary Murphy, the idea that her daughter would marry a Protestant was deeply offensive. She allegedly forbid the relationship early on, but Polly defied her mother and married McNeil anyway. 2 months later, Polly delivered a baby girl, which only made matters worse. This allegedly led to an estrangement for a few years, until shortly after the birth of her second child. Polly then had some sort of accident that left her paralyzed on one side of her body. The details of this accident are murky at best, but it's been suggested in the years since that McNeil might have had something to do with the injury. After the accident, the Murphys welcomed their eldest daughter and her family back into their household. They helped take care of Polly and her two young children. McNeil kept residence at a business he owned in town, but it purportedly burned down, leaving McNeil with a hefty insurance payout. By Christmas of 1898, he too was living in the Murphy house alongside his wife and children. On Boxing Day, the day of the murders, McNeil had apparently gotten quite drunk at the horse races. When the time came for Michael, Nora, and Ellen to leave for the Gatton dance, William offered to drive them, but they refused. Instead, he begrudgingly stayed home with his wife and children. His whereabouts afterward are spotty. Mary Murphy insisted to investigators that McNeil was home the entire night. Mrs. Murphy said that she went into their bedroom to get the table lamp after 11 p.m. and saw McNeil in bed. Daniel Murphy claimed he heard McNeil talking to his daughter, McNeil's wife, at around 12 a.m. midnight, but he never actually saw him that night. Polly said her husband came to bed and slept in his clothes. However, a neighbor later told police that Polly confided in her that McNeil had been out of the house for most of the night. Considering McNeil's quick discovery of the bodies the next morning, many surmised he may have already known that they were there. The fact that he was present for the post-mortem exams and then offered to pay for the funeral roused further suspicions. Police were initially suspicious of McNeil, but it seems like it never went beyond that. Perhaps the most likely of all suspects was a young drifter going by the name Thomas Day. Day had been in Gatton for a few weeks working for a butcher named Mr. Clark when the murders happened. His physical fitness and strength made him a perfect employee in Clark's slaughter yard. Clark offered Day room and board, and Day made his home in a shack a few yards behind the Clark home. It just so happened that the Clark property was located beside the same paddock where the Murphy bodies were found. Mr. Clark told investigators that on Boxing Night, he had held a fireworks display between 8 and 9 p.m., during which Thomas Day was the only member of the household not present. Investigators questioned Thomas Day about his whereabouts on the night of the murder, and he reported that he went to bed at 7 p.m., read until he fell asleep, and then never heard a sound during the night. Interestingly enough, the witness who had reported hearing a feminine voice call out "Father" on the night of the murders was actually staying at Mr. Clark's house, yet Day claimed he had heard nothing. Next, police searched his room and found a shirt with blood spatter on the sleeves. Day explained this away by claiming it was animal blood transferred to his clothing as he carried wet meat into town with his bare hands. He was told not to wash the shirt, but within days, Day had scrubbed the garment completely clean. While he had the proximity and physical strength to have committed the murders, for some reason Frederick Urquhart refused to consider him a viable suspect. Stephanie Bennett, the author of the book The Gatton Murders, surmises this is because Day was a mildly educated man. Investigators found the man reading 14th century Italian poetry when they came to question him about the Gatton murders. Given Urquhart's aristocratic background, he believed that educated people couldn't commit heinous crimes. Urquhart gave Day personal permission to leave the area, and after a brief stint in the British Armed Forces in Brisbane, Thomas Day deserted and all but disappeared. There were other constables who objected to Urquhart's dismissal of Thomas Day as a suspect, including Sergeant Arell, the initial investigator on the scene the day that the bodies were found. It came out at the Royal Commission inquiry into the Queensland Police's conduct a few months later that Urquhart had threatened Arell and others with termination, along with general unpleasantness, i.e., "I'll make your life a living hell," if they didn't stop talking about Thomas Day. What was Urquhart's explanation behind the police's failure to solve the Murphy murders? In his words, "We have failed because from the very outset, we had no chance of success." On Saturday, October 27th, 1900, a Western Australia newspaper reported on the suicide of a man known as Theo Farmer. However, it was quickly discovered that Theo Farmer was the new alias of Thomas Day, who had deserted a short time prior. The short newspaper article read, "At an inquest today concerning the death of Theo Farmer, who died in the Sydney hospital from results of a revolver wound, self-inflicted in a lodging house on Wednesday last, a letter, which was scribbled in pencil found on the deceased, was produced. It was of a rambling character and contained a number of allusions to the Gatton tragedy. It read, 'Just a few words wishing to inform the public about the Gatton murder, which I suppose or hope will be found out when I am no more. I am going to my long rest, but still before I leave the world, I wish to state what I know for a certain fact.' Then followed a statement relating to several people in the Gatton district. The letter continued, 'I know the public may wonder, but I do not wonder, as I am quite sure the case was to be kept quiet among the police, which I think is about time they were shown up. So, hoping the Gatton affair will go ahead, I will conclude. A verdict of suicide was returned.'" The suicide note was not an explicit confession, but it remains one of the strongest pieces of evidence linking Thomas Day to the Gatton murders. Given the evidence that Nora and Ellen had been raped by several perpetrators, it may be possible that Tom Day linked up with a gang of locals and attacked the Murphys on their way home that night. To this day, many believe him to be the most logical suspect in the murders of Michael, Nora, and Ellen Murphy, but given the passage of time, it's almost impossible to confirm the true identity of the murderer or murderers. Unfortunately, this case looks like it will always remain unresolved. Thank you for listening to this episode of Unresolved. Research and writing for this episode was performed by Maggie Coomer. Many of the specific details about the Murphys' personal lives, the detectives, the post-mortem exams, and the lives of the suspects comes from Stephanie Bennett's book, The Gatton Murders, a true story of lust, revenge, and vile retribution. She did extensive research within the Australian archives and scoured the primary source documents for details about this case. Without her hard work, this episode would be just another generic retelling of this 120-year-old case. And thanks to Maggie for doing such a good job with it. She is about to give birth to her first child, so I would just like to say, congratulations, Maggie. Hosting and production for this episode was done by me, Michael Whelan. The music you're hearing in this episode was composed by myself through Amper Music, except for the song you're hearing now, the Unresolved theme song, which was written and composed by Ailsa Traves. To get a full list of sources and references for this episode, you can check out the podcast website at unresolved.me. There, each story that I cover has its own page, where you can follow along with a transcript or find our sources and additional research links. If you would like to help support this podcast and gain access to our archive of exclusive digital content, please head to patreon.com/unresolvedpod. Or search for Unresolved Pod in the Patreon app. Those of you that are in the tiers to get new episodes of Resolved are in for a treat in the near future. I will soon be covering the story of one of the most infamous serial killers of all time, in a multi-part series that goes into excruciating detail. It's something that I've been working on for several weeks now, and I am very excited to get out to you in the near future. I also have several bonus episodes lined up, so those of you in the $2.50 tier also have content coming your way very soon. Anyhow, thank you all so much, and thank you to everyone that has recently left us reviews on Apple Podcasts or other podcast apps. Those really go a long way to help support the show and are always appreciated, as is your continued patronage. Until next time, I hope you all stay safe, stay healthy, and if you can, please get vaccinated. I will talk to you later.